Well, we have just heard a very hard reading and then a very deeply moving song. Thank you, Effie. And I want to invite everyone to just take a moment, to take a breath, a deep breath. Feel the chair supporting you, your feet on the ground. The presence of people here, the presence of loved ones here. Take a slow breath, let it out. Another breath. And know that you belong to this moment, and this moment belongs to you. Blessed Spirit of love and truth, guide my words as we seek to speak truth with love. Blessed be not me, but thee, Spirit of love and Spirit of truth. Thank you, Reverend Justine, for inviting Effie and me to be here at Seaview this morning. And thanks to all of you who are here and for this privilege of being with you this morning. I want to thank everyone who's part of this congregation. And I want to say I am so impressed with y'all. You have moved just, I understand, last July into this fabulous building. You are filling it with good work and wonderful people. Oh my gosh, I want you to know how hard that is. I know it took you a while, but that is an awesome thing to have accomplished. And I'm really, 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 really impressed. And everybody I've met has been so gracious and welcoming. I also want you to know that you're really lucky that you've got Justine, that you could not do better to have an interim minister. Both the reading and the story for all ages this morning, and what I have to tell you is about interrupting the status quo, changing things. Changing the narrative, as Brian Stevenson says. Changing the narrative. And before I go too far, I want to say that immediately after the service, we will have the second showing of a film that was premiered on Wednesday. It's a 7-minute film, and I want to invite everyone to stay, called Remembering Elwood Higginbottom, that was created and produced and shown for the first time this last Wednesday at the Oxford Film Festival, and we're seeing it for the second time. But I want to start this morning by telling you a hard story. But it is also a story of hope. It is also a story of hope, and there is such goodness, and I think this is a story for our times because there are such hard things going on, and yet I see so many good things going on as well. I see Effie coming to this service to bring the gift of her voice and her song. I see Justine leading this congregation. I see so many good things going on. So in the midst of hardness, there's also hope. And as I tell you this story, I'd ask that you hold this man's extended family in your heart and in your prayers. I'd like to start by reading the words on the marker that is now at a busy intersection in Oxford, Mississippi. The lynching of Elwood Higginbottom. On the evening of September 17th, 1935, Elwood Higginbottom, a 28-year-old African-American tenant farmer, husband, father to three, was in custody in the Oxford jail. 4 months earlier, landholder Glenn Roberts had led a posse to Higginbottom's house over a property dispute. Higginbottom defended himself and his family and fled after Roberts was fatally shot. And after Roberts' funeral, citizens of Oxford and the county joined with the officers of Lafayette County and other counties in a manhunt. They beat Higginbottom's sister and threatened burning his brothers to death in retaliation. Captured a few days later in Pontotoc County, Higginbottom was held in Jackson until his trial date in Oxford. With anger mounting that a guilty verdict was not forthcoming quickly enough, a mob of 50 to 150 white men gathered outside the jail. They broke in, and they drove Higginbottom to a wooden area near a place called Three Way on Old Russell Road. Higginbottom fought for his life, but the mob forced a rope around his neck and hanged him to his death. Reports describe 5 bullet holes in his body. The lynching sparked outrage with NAACP, who wrote to Franklin D. Roosevelt and blamed Higginbottom's death on callous indifference towards federal or state protections against anarchic mobs. Roosevelt's administration did nothing. Officials in Mississippi charged no one. At the time of the murder, there was a very short article. It was about that big in the Oxford paper. And after that, nothing. 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 For decades, nothing in the white newspapers. And it wasn't until 2015 that changed. In 2015, an Oxford editor, John Scott, having gotten a book from the Equal Justice Initiative, wrote an op-ed saying, "This shameful history must be brought to light. We must talk about it." Why was there silence? There's all kinds of different reasons. My first coming to this story and learning about that silence, I assumed it was shame. It was white shame. And that may be a piece of it, and that's my projection, that's my understanding, that's certainly what I felt. But the historian who's working with us is becoming quite appalled in reading those early newspaper reports on that's just how it was. The silence was that's just how it was, the status quo. On October 27th, just this last fall, 2018, the community of Oxford did a very, very hard thing. We recognized and we memorialized Elwood Higginbottom, the last known person to be lynched in Lafayette County. There are over 6. A diverse group of more than 500 people gathered to name the horrific wrong done to Elwood and to his family, and to honor his memory, and to celebrate him as a person, a husband, a father, a provider to his family, and also a sharecropper organizer. There's now a marker in Oxford stating this truth. To the best of my knowledge, it's the first one in Mississippi, even though Mississippi was arguably the epicenter of the racial terrorism that took the form of lynching. That event broke 83 years of public silence. And for me, even though I'd been part of the 2-year-long process, even though I had read all that I could about this event and indeed about lynching, and I had met Elwood's son and nephew and niece, for me, that public event changed me. For me, I felt a deep shift. That while that service was going on, while Effie sang, as she did for us today, as his gathered family gathered literally from across the country, gathered and sang and shared their stories, as family members spoke about how they grew up not knowing what happened to their father and their grandfather, there was just an empty place, an emptiness in their hearts, not knowing. And even as the marker was revealed to the public for the first time, to a gasp of this gathered crowd, for me, it was in that time Elwood Higginbottom became a person. No longer that vague category in my head of victim, or worse, lynching victim, with the question that's right next to it, well, what did he do wrong? What did he do to deserve that? He became a person to me. He became a man, a subject, not an object. I had a thou experience, or perhaps an I-thou, as my subjectiveness intersected with his subjectiveness. A man who deserved to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. A man who deserved to raise his children. A man who deserved the best of what this hurting world can offer. And in that, I have to acknowledge, I realized my awakening is ongoing. I am not there yet. I thought I had gotten somewhere, and I'm not there yet. That this deep systemic racism and white supremacy, which our country was founded on, is pervasive, it's deep, and it colonizes our minds. And I have a dear friend who said that she is realizing, as I am, this is a lifetime of work. And it is a special work for white folks. It is a special work because we've lived with this privilege of not having to think about it. We've lived with the privilege of, oh my gosh, that's painful. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to think about that. And it is our duty, it is our task to listen. It is our duty and our task to learn. It is our duty and our task to share some of this burden. And it was also in this service that I got a glimpse, and I know it's just a glimpse, of the burden that has been carried for so awfully, awfully long, that burden that has been carried by only a portion of our community. The awful history and memory is carried too often alone by our brothers and sisters with darker skin. It is not carried by people whose skin color is most like the perpetrators of this crime. And I need to say, Oxford is not over its racism. We have a long way to go. We are not close to being the community that we could be, the thriving, vibrant, multiracial community that we could be. We have a long way to go, and Lord knows Mississippi has a long way to go, and this country has a long way to go, and I dare say Virginia has some work to do as well. But I hope you can, I don't know if celebrate's the right word, I hope you can join with me in knowing that we have done something that was not done for nearly a century. And I'd like to take just a little bit of time to say a little bit about how this happened, because it was done carefully, and it's not easy to do. When something's not talked about for 80 years, it is hard to talk about. It is hard to talk about. There's no getting around that. And so every program I'm part of that's acknowledged. When our community group started meeting about 2 years ago, there was not a roadmap. Everybody wanted a roadmap. What do we do? Tell me the steps. We can do it. There was not even a clear destination, right? Should there be one marker? Should there be multiple markers? Should we have it on the square? Should we have it somewhere else? There was just all kinds of questions. And people who like to work on those kinds of details had jumped in, and they were ready to do something next week. Some people were saying, wait a minute, we don't even know how we're going to pay for this. How are we going to do this? And there were some of us who were saying, wait a minute, we need to sit with ashes and sackcloth in mourning for a year or maybe a decade. But what I saw over the last 2 years was a dedicated group of people finding their way forward. Sometimes it was a little like a person moving in the dark, shuffling along, trying not to bump their toes too hard. You know, you're going to bump them a little bit, but you can get there. And it was so clear so early that different people brought different gifts. And there were really four things that helped to guide us, and I want to just briefly mention those. The first one is that our conversations always started with a reading or reflection that was front and center, that we were talking about a murder, that we were talking about a crime, we were talking about a horrific event. You know, even as some folks wanted to jump into the details, it's like, no, we have to say this. The reading helped us to slow down. Helped us to know it was bigger than any one of us. In the rising of the sun and its going down, we remember him. In the blowing of the wind and the chill of the winter, we remember him. In the opening of the buds and in the rebirth of spring, we remember him. I also want to highlight that this work and the conversations were done in covenant. We had guideposts for our conversations. I shared our guideposts this morning in the adult forum and have shared them with Reverend Justine. And with these guideposts, we could acknowledge hurt and pain. We could acknowledge that different people had different experiences and spoke different truths. And we learned to stay at the table through those difficult conversations. One of the guideposts says, when the going gets tough, turn to wonder. It's so easy to turn to blame. It's so easy to take the discomfort and go, it's their fault. Okay? But no, turn to wonder. What can I learn? What can I learn from this person? What can I learn from this group? What can I learn about here and now? What can I learn about this beautiful world? My experience as a white person is one who's lived with a lot of privilege. It's very different from experiences of people of color who've had less privilege. We had one wonderful event called Know Your Number, and this was a wonderfully interracial group that came together, and the moderators talked us through all kinds of different questions. Like, you know, did you grow up with books in your house? And was there any expectation of going to college? And with each thing, you get a different number. And at the end, they said, well, go to where your number is. And the numbers were arranged from high to low. And it was stunning how many, I mean, just how people sorted out. I was on the medium high level of privilege. I grew up with education and parents who supported me. There were folks who grew up with no parents and no books. And I heard one person behind me saying, you know, I didn't have anything to do with any of these questions that were asked. I didn't choose what family I was born into. That was that person's first realization of, oh my gosh, I think I'm an accomplished person, but I didn't have anything to do with these helps that I had along the way. A third thing I want to mention is that there was an agreement very quickly and a clarity early on that the Higginbottom family had to be central. They became involved with the process early on. They came to some of the first meetings, and it was very clear that whatever they needed, we would help provide. And any decision we made had to be made with them in mind. And since this was the last known lynching, that's going to be harder for some of the earlier ones that we seek to memorialize. But it turns out such a blessing to know this family, to learn of this family. In the film, you'll see just a little bit about that. And this is where the roadmap, it wouldn't have helped if we had a roadmap. Nobody dreamed that we'd connect with thousands of people. Nobody dreamed that they'd be willing to come back. Nobody dreamed that there'd be an ongoing relationship. The last thing I wanted to mention is that we worked in partnership with several organizations. I want to acknowledge the William Winter Institute for Racial Reconciliation. It's been working in Mississippi and other states for over 20 years. They use those guideposts. They have fabulous programs. They have a program for rising juniors, so they get juniors from high school together for a program in justice and empower those people to make change in their communities. Equal Justice Initiative was also a partner. They provided scholarships for our program. Those scholarships brought in the high school students. They wrote essays as a competition, and four people got scholarships for $4,000. They also provided funding for the markers. So the barrier that seemed like, oh my gosh, how are we going to pay for this, was not a barrier at all. It was like, okay, they have got that covered. And then the other group was the Civil Rights Restorative Justice Project of Northeastern University School of Law. A student from there was researching this particular case, and it was her visit that sparked the conversations. She'd been doing research for a class. She came to Oxford and also Memphis to find the family. She was shocked that there was nothing about any lynching in Oxford at all. She was shocked. I mean, she'd spent 6 months studying this, and it's like, that's what she knew. It's like, and then Oxford, it was like, there was nothing. The story of the extended Higginbottom family being connected is nothing short of extraordinary. Through an Ancestry.com search, through the publication of an op-ed piece that I mentioned in the Oxford paper in 2015, and then through the research by Kylene Burke at Northeastern University, all of these pieces contributed in ways that we couldn't plan, in ways that we couldn't make happen. It's that spirit, it's moving. We couldn't have made that happen, but it came together. Those things were coming together at the same time, with the result that the extended Higginbottom family literally began finding each other from all over the country. It was after our second meeting that I got to meet Elwood's son, E.W. He was 4 years old when his father was lynched. Now he's 87. His first time back to Oxford, he said this. He said he wished he'd had a father. He would have loved to have a father. And his mother didn't talk about what happened. He didn't know what happened. And I suspect it's not surprising the mother did not talk of that. I mean, the silence in the African-American community, especially that family, I mean, it's got to be just about coping in the immediacy. He also said, as hard as it is to know, it's better to know than to not know. One family member I was privileged to meet, she's in the film, was Valerie Reeves. She's a cousin to Elwood, who lives in Atlanta, and she's the historian of the family. Her brother had started researching the family, but died in 2017, and she was reeling from that loss. And she said through that memorialization process, she found new hope in finding family members, members she never dreamed of. Here's what she said at one of our meetings. "This is really a phenomenal thing. When I lost my brother, we were very close, and I did not know how I was going to go on. But through the memorialization project I inherited from my brother, I have more family than I know what to do with. I have over 2,000 family members that we have connected. We started having family meetups, so we are actually getting to know each other. We are getting to see each other and see what each other looks like, and we see ourselves in each other's faces." At that same time, at that same meeting, Alonzo Hilliard, one of our members, said this: "You have a family who didn't have an understanding of what happened to their father and their grandfather. Through this process, they have had a chance to see that their father, their grandfather, made a difference. He stood up for the sharecropper community. He made a difference for the people in the area. He died protecting his family. He loved them. He wanted to keep his property, and because of that, he stood up for himself. And because of that, he was lynched. I honor this family. The Higginbottom family should have been pillars in our community, not terrorized and scattered. We can only imagine what talents and gifts they would have brought to the Oxford community. And it is my prayer that through this effort and others, the community can be transformed to a community of truth tellers and a community that looks out for one another across racial lines, a community where the whole community bears the burden of history." Through this, I feel like I've seen beloved community. I've seen careful working together. I've seen people knowing they're in difficult land, difficult country, and carefully moving forward. Alonzo Hilliard was the chair of the committee that I was on, and close to the event, he sent an email to this disparate group of people, and he said, "We are doing good work. I love you guys." It was the sweetest thing. What is possible? What is possible? All things are possible. What is possible? It's the nature of white supremacy to be doers. Just make it happen. Do it. Decide what needs to be done and do it. It's the nature of white supremacy. It's very hierarchical. It's the nature of a bully taking what they want. We see examples from the highest levels in our country, making a decision, making it happen. This is sometimes called the ethic of control. I want to contrast that with the ethic of risk. This is something, a phrase that Sharon Welch has used. She's a UU theologian and author. And she says, with the ethic of risk, you let go of that control. You let go of that outcome. You say, okay, there's not a roadmap. But that doesn't stop you from moving. It's more like nurturing a garden than bulldozing a place. Ethic of control is like a bulldozer, literally. Ethic of risk, nurturing a garden. It takes relationship. It takes time. It takes principle. It takes covenant. Teilhard de Chardin calls this the slow work of God. It feels so hard to me that this is the only memorialization in Mississippi, but that's so far. Feels so hard, there's still so much painness in the lack of sharing that. 27 seconds. A dear friend said this to me. It was at a party. She's somebody I admire a lot. She actually was the first leader of the William Winter Institute. Huh? I said, I'd been describing to her some of what I've told you this morning, and that I had glimpsed beloved community. And she said, 27 seconds. I said, okay. So she's someone I respected a lot. I said, okay, tell me more. Here's what she told me. That's the length of the time of the first flight of the Wright brothers. 27 seconds, early 1900s. Anyone in their right mind would have called that a failure. 27 seconds, that didn't work. Boom, right? Yet from those 27 seconds, people imagined flight was possible. And I believe I've seen more than 27 seconds of beloved community, and we have now people who believe beloved community is possible. It is possible. Certainly there's challenges, and there's certainly challenges that belong to white people. There's other challenges for African Americans, but I believe it takes leaning in. Leaning in. When you lean in, you're a bit off balance. I hate being off balance. But that's it. You lean in and you're off balance. You fall forward. Bryan Stevenson said he searched hard and wide to see if change ever happens without struggle, and he has not found any examples. Okay? So we need to get used to that. And leaning in, you might also find yourself leading in. As you're daring to have a conversation, as you're daring to do something, as you're daring to step out, as you're daring to change the status quo in big ways and in little ways, it's those little ways that add up, you may find yourself leading in. And there's also learning in. There's lots to learn. I'd like to close this morning with a quote from Bryan Stevenson from the book Just Mercy. We are all implicated when we allow other people to be mistreated. An absence of compassion can corrupt the decency of a community, a state, a nation. Fear and anger makes us vindictive and abusive, unjust and unfair, until we all suffer from the absence of mercy and we condemn ourselves as much as we victimize others. That goes hand in hand. The closer we get to mass incarceration and extreme levels of punishment, the more I believe it is necessary to recognize we all need mercy. We all need justice, and perhaps we all need some measure of unmerited grace. That grace is accessible here and now. It's still here for all of us, here and now. Effie's going to lead us in singing Amazing Grace.
I will sing.